All right, so welcome everyone. This is SANI, the podcast that celebrates our African scientists. I'm your host, Alex Nyako. I am a senior research specialist at Avery Dennison. And today we are excited to be joined by Dr. Elizabeth Nebier. She is an associate professor at the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at the Arizona State University. So, Dr. Nebier, thank you so much for joining us today on SANI.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Alex. And just to clarify, I'm an assistant professor, associate maybe in a few years.
Thank you for that correction. I'll make a note of that. So, Dr. Nebier, I would like to zoom in into our discussion for today. And when we speak with our interviewees who come on our platform, we always want to start with just the background information on knowing a bit more about their career journey. So, how did your past experiences, your upbringing, your schooling in Burkina Faso influence and shape your career path, and specifically influence and shape the field that you currently pursue?
Okay, thank you for the question. That's actually a question I really like, and I can take days to talk about this. I will try to summarize, because it's not very typical what I did, but I will just try to summarize in a few minutes. So to start, I identify as an anthropologist, and I study the human dimensions of environmental change. So far, most of my research has focused on climate adaptation and food and water insecurity in the amazing country of Burkina Faso in West Africa. And this is actually where I grew up. So my upbringing, my schooling, and my experience in that country definitely influenced my career path. Because from a young age, I knew that I would be pursuing doctoral studies. And this is really a goal that was set to me by my parents. I was raised by my stepmother, who is a role model in my life. And part of her own career, she was a high school and vocational school professor. So she would always tell us, as a woman, your work should be your first husband. And I want my girls to succeed in life. I have an older sister. And she would always also tell us, go to school as long as you can. So I grew up with this philosophy in my mind. But what motivated my specific interest for climate change research is really my experience living in Burkina Faso. For those of you who know Burkina, the country is in the Sahel region of West Africa, which is quite dry. And the country experienced, especially the northern part of the country, experienced lots of droughts in the past, especially in the 1970s and 1980s. So I completed my undergraduate education back home in Burkina, and my bachelor's thesis looked at the climate diplomacy of Burkina Faso back in 2010. And the reason why I chose this topic is because I remember that the first day of my internship at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, because I was an international relations major, and doing this internship with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was a requirement. So I remember the first day of my internship day was marked by one of the most massive floods that the country ever experienced. And we always talked about drought when referring to Burkina Faso. So no one was really prepared for a flood. And this event really strengthened my interest in climate-related issues. 4 months after my thesis defense, my bachelor's thesis defense, I got a Fulbright scholarship from the US Department of State to pursue graduate studies in the US. And here again, I applied to this scholarship because I knew my family wouldn't be able to afford sending me abroad. So I knew that only hard work would allow me to do so. And when I graduated from my master's, I decided that I wanted to pursue studies in anthropology because I wanted to learn more about the suitable methods for community-based research. And the reason I wanted to do so is because growing up again in Burkina, I realized how much knowledge is embedded in rural communities, but this is often underestimated in research and development projects. And I experienced firsthand the failure of many development projects that did not fully involve local communities. And I really didn't want to replicate that as a development practitioner. That is why I applied to the anthropology program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I got the opportunity to work closely with rural communities, with scientists, policymakers, and also development practitioners on food, environment, and sustainability projects. Even though I was an anthropology major, I took classes in geographic information systems, remote sensing, and gender analysis because I was really interested in learning, gaining skills that students from other departments also had. I wanted to be more like an interdisciplinary scholar. And these skills really helped me because when I started working on my own research as a faculty, I was able to collaborate with people from other disciplines. And when you talk about climate change and environmental change, you have people from diverse disciplines who are interested in these issues. So it was very important for me to gain these skills that are very diverse in order to collaborate better with people. And something I wanted to add is that I'm an academic. I work as an assistant professor at Arizona State University, but I collaborate also with people who are outside of academia. I was involved in projects with UNESCO, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the International Development Research Center in Canada, and the International Livestock Research Institute. And actually, the International Livestock Research Institute funded my dissertation fieldwork back in Burkina Faso when I was in my doctoral program. So this is, to make the story shorter, these are all the experiences that shaped me into what I'm doing today and who I am.
That's very interesting. It's always intriguing to hear how the environmental factors around those we interview really spur them on to do what they are actually doing now. You made a point about how when you were in Burkina Faso, some of the policies and scientists who were coming to do research were not necessarily doing things which were impactful in the environment, and that's why you wanted to make a huge change. Would you like to comment a bit on that? And what do you think are some of the flaws that were being undertaken in the research, and that's why that massive impact were not necessarily being observed?
I actually meant development projects, and development projects are quite different from what researchers do. Mm. And actually, when you go to the field as a researcher, sometimes people think that you are a development practitioner because they are used to having people, outsiders, come into their communities, especially in rural areas, with projects. And so that's the problem. And what is different between a researcher and a development practitioner is that the researcher goes with a study question. And some researchers nowadays who are involved in participatory research actually try to work with local communities to come up with a research question that is of interest to them. Mm-hmm. But what is different with development practitioner is that some of them may not be from the community. They might not even know much about the community and come with projects that are not always suitable for local needs, or like that is not even suitable for the community. So right. The community is not always involved in the design of the project. And that's why a lot of projects have failed. So as a master's student in international development, I actually came across some of these projects that failed. And I didn't want to be a development practitioner that would be doing that. I wanted to be one who work with local communities, understand them, and able to work together with them to come up with projects that are successful. So that's what I meant in the first part of my answer.
Yes, yeah, totally understand. Yeah, so really homegrown solutions, and necessarily
exactly
those not coming in and bringing in solutions. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us more about your current research focus? You know, you're working on human dimensions of environmental change, climate adaptation, and food and water insecurity in West Africa. Can you able to explain that in layman terms and really let us know what are some of the main areas or problems that your research is trying to address?
Sure. So I work on different projects. So when I get this question, sometimes I don't even know what to answer because I'm really interdisciplinary. And but I will just tell you about a few things that I'm doing right now. So most of my research, I work with herders, and I work with Fulani herders who were resettled in more humid saffron areas of Burkina Faso after the droughts that affected dry areas of the country in the 1970s. And my field site is in saffron Burkina Faso in the Zondwego province. And in my research, I study how these herders adapt to the new environment and to climate change in general. Even though most of my work involves rural communities, I'm actually working on diverse collaborative projects that are also ranging from water and food insecurity to seasonal migration decision making among herders. So that's the umbrella. That's a very rough summary of what I'm involved in. And what is interesting with all these studies is that the type of methods that I use. As an anthropologist, for example, I conduct field work, and conducting field work means traveling to the field site, spending time with people and learning from them. They know a lot, but this knowledge is underestimated, and I will never repeat that enough. They know a lot. And because many development practitioners, and I was pointing this out, do not actually value that knowledge. When I go to the field, sometimes people will tell me, oh, when I ask them what they know about something, they will tell me, oh, no, you know better than us. And I'm always like, no, if I came here to ask you these questions, it's because I know that you know better than I do. And you've been able to survive these environmental changes that are happening in your community. You're using your local knowledge, not just resources that you get from the government. You have your own ways of adapting to climate change. And I'm interested in knowing what you do to adapt. Because if you know what they are doing, you're better able to leverage that and provide them with resources that are needed to build their capacity. But if you don't know the local knowledge that they use, it's very hard because you're bringing external knowledge that might be hard for them to actually replicate in their specific regions. And you asked me about the main problems that I'm trying to address. The major thing I'm trying to do is to document their knowledge, as I said, because in climate change research, this is often omitted because we might tend to think about, you know, science. We might tend to think about bringing in climate information, forecasting information, but we also have indigenous knowledge, and we have knowledge from diverse groups like women who know their environment. They know, for example, they have perceptions of climate change that it's important for us to understand, because when they go into the forest to harvest fruits or vegetables to feed their families, they are able to tell you what is changing in the environment that they actually, like on the wood when they go to get certain vegetables. Or men, transhuman herders, they walk long distance. And nowadays they will tell you that they actually have to walk even longer, sometimes crossing boundaries between one country to another one, because now it's getting harder and harder to get access to certain resources. So these are the type of people I talk to in my research. I just don't put everything under the same umbrella. I try to differentiate to make sure that every segment of society is included in the type of research that I do. And this is because they experience the effects of climate change differently sometimes based on their gender, based on their livelihood systems. And it's very important to come up with targeted solutions that are suitable for each group. And I'm a big proponent of participatory methods that involve the communities I work with as much as possible.
Thank you for that. So, in regards to participatory methods, can you comment a bit on some of the methods you use and engaging the communities as you learn from them, and you also will take advantage of the solutions that you bring on board?
Yes. So I use participatory mapping most of the time because I'm interested in environmental change. So I will print out a satellite image because I told you I did some remote sensing as a student. So I will print out a satellite image and bring it with me, a high resolution one, and bring it with me to the field. And then we have focus groups with men and women separately, and also with the youth. So the question I ask them first, I try to show the different directions, because some of them are not very used with these images. Some of them have never seen these images before, but they are really there to get the conversation started. And these images, if you're familiar with them, they don't provide you with lots of information. You're able to see pictures, you're able sometimes to see the roads when you have a high resolution one, and trees. So when you have from images like this from the 1970s to today, you're able to see changes in specific areas, but it doesn't tell you what happened. So you want people to tell you what happened, what is behind the changes that you see. If, for example, a place was green in the 1970s and you print out the same image in 2023 and it's not green, that's where you want people to tell you what happened. So this is why I have these focus groups with them. I tell them about like my understanding of the image, and I ask them in specific areas, what do you think happened? And these maps help get the conversation started, because they will be like, oh, this is my house and there was this thing there before, but people have started cutting trees, or there was more migration into the area, and that's why you see this degradation happen. And when there is an area that is also getting green, I want to understand what happened. So I ask them and they're like, oh, we actually started planting trees in that particular area, and that's why it's green compared to before. So this is giving us a larger perspective of what is happening in the area, because you can go sit down and talk to a farmer in the field, but you are missing the bigger picture. But when they're able to see their village on a map like this, it also gives them, it also allows them to better show you what is going on in a particular place that you might not be familiar with, but that people are able to see on the map. So this is an example of the participatory methods that I'm using.
That's very interesting. So when some of these factors are identified, how do you go about in helping them to rectify some of these negative impacts or sources of impact that's really affecting them?
That's a great question. As an anthropologist, I'm trying to understand why they do what they're doing, because I'm not going to judge. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes,
because that's clear. In the case of, for example, when you look at extensive agriculture, I work in Burkina Faso, you have farmers who are involved in extensive agriculture. They will move from field to field, leave the field to fallow for a certain number of years, and then move to another field. And then it's the area ends up getting degraded. So when you see this type of practice, you can make a judgment. You can be like, oh, these people are destroying the environment. As an anthropologist, I want to understand why they behave this way. And there is a logic behind it. So just to answer your question, after they tell me what they're doing, I'm not trying to convince them to change. I'm trying to understand the logic behind what they're doing first. And then on the next phase of my career, because I have a development background, and the type of question you ask when you have a development background, it's hard not to tell them what to do, because, you know, development projects always have this action-oriented phase. But maybe in the next part of my career, once I have a better understanding of the logic behind what they're doing, then I will be in a better position to make some recommendations. But for now, I'm still trying to understand.
Right. Yeah. That completely makes sense. So having the researcher approach versus the developmental policy approach.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like to learn, in your role now as assistant professor in University of Arizona, what does a usual day as an active researcher look like in your field?
Okay. A usual day involves, for me, it involves waking up early and being ready to answer lots of emails from my collaborators and also from my students. Because as a faculty, I teach about 20% of a semester, and I spend about 70% of my time working on research. And I would say maybe 5 to 10% on service responsibilities for the university. But I will say that every day I interact with at least one person for something related to my research, either by email virtually on Zoom or in person. And because I'm also a mother and a wife, I have to take those responsibilities also into account as well during my day. For example, for our meeting today, I asked that we meet at a certain time because of that. And as an active researcher in my field, you will be doing some field work at least once a year, going to your field site and collecting some data, like strengthen connections at least once a year, usually in the summer when we have less teaching responsibilities. But in my case, with COVID-19, travel restrictions and motherhood, I've not really been able to do it recently. I haven't been able to go to the field to collect some data myself. But I'm actually using this as an opportunity to uplift my colleagues, my collaborators who are in Burkina Faso. They are on site and they are very much able to collect data as part of my research. So what I've done recently is really uplift them, give them the resources so they can collect the data, even if I'm not able to do it. So that's what a usual day or a usual year will look for me as an active researcher, as an anthropologist.
That's great. Thank you for sharing. I know there's a lot of focus on Burkina Faso. Mm-hmm. Are you also looking at other areas to try and understand where the sources of climate change is happening?
Yes, I was a postdoc at Columbia University, and as part of my postdoc, I actually worked on a project in Senegal. And our goal was to identify places that were food insecure and more vulnerable to the effects of climate change. So we were using data, climate data, because my mentor was a climate scientist. So we were using climate data to try to identify that. And we merged the climate data with food insecurity, food security data from the World Food Program. So yes, to your question, Senegal is one of the places where I'm also working.
So when you look at your research career so far, could you share with us some of the memorable highlights and the lowlights that you've experienced so far in your work?
Yes. I would say the highlights of my research are times when I work with local communities and they get really excited to share information with me because they trust me. Because when they're excited to share information with you, it's really because they trust that you will use this information. And another highlight that I would like to share is when I have a community study me. I'm not not me studying the community only, but the community studying me. And let me explain this because it's really amazing. We already talked about that. There has been a lot of development projects that came into places where I work, and people are tired and they no longer trust, some of them no longer trust outsiders. So when I was conducting my dissertation research in Southern Burkina Faso, a few community members knew how to write. So during the focus groups I had with them, they were also taking notes about everything I asked and what they told me. So if someone was observing us, maybe the person will say that I was also being the one being studied. So, and this is because they are taking measures to be cautious and document the information that they share with people who are not from their community. And this can be helpful for them down the road. Because this is the result of years of exploitative research in these communities, and people are finding ways to adapt to that. So I found that very interesting, and I think it's a great thing to do, to document also what they share with people. Because, you know, oral tradition in Africa is a lot of people don't know how to write. So a lot of things are not documented. But by me seeing them actually write down the type of questions I ask and what they're telling me, just tells me that things are changing, and this is great for these people. Something more personal is that as a junior scholar, one highlight, of course, and this applies to any researcher, is that when you work on a project and it finally gets published, it's very rewarding. So this is a major highlight for anybody who is doing research. Mm-hmm. But the low lights of my research are the moments when I cannot go to the field, like now, due to growing mm-hmm. insecurity in Burkina Faso, and especially in the area where I work. So I had to change field sites. I also had to adapt, as I told you, I'm trying to uplift local collaborators. Mm-hmm. But this is a low light for me because I'm not able to go back to the community where I worked as a PhD student. And that really breaks my heart. The other issues that I have in my research are also the fact that people are confusing research and development. And we already talked about that. Right. And I think that's a challenge for researchers, because when you get into a rural community right nowadays and you tell people that you want to talk to them about a particular matter, it is hard to convince them that you're not coming in with a project. So mm-hmm. what I always say, I have to clarify that the goal of my research is to better understand a situation and ultimately inform potential development projects. If inform them even that much better, but I'm not bringing in a new project myself at the moment. And if I had to work on a community project, the ideas would come from the community, not from me as an outsider. And if I have to help to design a development project, the idea will come from what I learned from that community. And right. this is actually why I went into anthropology.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. So as a segue from that, so when you explain to them mm-hmm. The differences between you conducting research versus development project, mm-hmm. what is the level of reception to that kind of messaging?
I didn't have any problem with that because they were okay with it. At least I was honest. Right. It was like, okay, so now, okay, we get it. We get it. And I didn't have any issues with people not answering my questions because I'm not bringing in the project. So mm-hmm. I didn't have any issues with that. I think people actually like when you're honest with them mm-hmm. because some people will come, just ask these questions and never return.
Right.
But I want to build a relationship with the community. So I actually better come back. And I actually have to make it clear from the beginning, because if you want to build a relationship, you should then also make them think that you're bringing something that is not true. Yes. So it wasn't hard to make them understand that.
That's awesome. That's good to hear. So we'd like to conclude by asking, what advice will you leave with young and aspiring scientists from Africa who are looking at doing similar work that you're doing, or who are even looking at going into other fields? What advice will you leave with young and aspiring African scientists?
Okay, I do not have a magic recipe, but from my own experience, I would say, don't be shy approaching people as you look for opportunities. And today with new technologies, it has become much easier to find people working on topics that you might be interested in. And this is actually how I found my own PhD advisor online on Google. And I'm working with an excellent team of researchers, for example, here at the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at Arizona State University. And our programs offer unique programming in anthropology, archaeology, global health, and environmental science. And I receive lots of emails from young Africans who are interested in applying to our programs. Mm-hmm. Here, I have to say that I'm always thrilled when I come across these emails, because more and more young Africans aspire to pursue their education after their master's degree. And many of these applicants have very competitive profiles. Mm-hmm. They want to further their education abroad, because some of them are unable to find programs that they are interested in their home countries. But the common thing I see across all these different peoples is that they want their research to focus on issues that are proper to Africa. Mm. And all of them want to study issues in their home countries. And I think this is so important for Africa's future, because people are not just going abroad to study and stay there, but even when they stay, they still want to study their continent. And this is very, very important. And here I will conclude by saying that if you want to become a researcher, don't let anything stop you. Be resilient. Don't be afraid to make mistakes, because mistakes will happen. And something else is that your trajectory may not be linear. Mine was not linear. I've not always been an anthropologist. I mentioned that I went into development studies, and before that, international relations. So your trajectory may not be linear, but this will make your experience even better. And finally, I will say, enjoy and celebrate every success, and have in mind that you can also inspire other young Africans tomorrow.
Thank you so much for those encouraging words and uplifting words as well. So we'd like to thank you, Dr. Nibia, for spending time with us today on Sunny, really sharing your experiences, sharing the work that you are doing, sharing the different challenges, and sharing really the encouraging and uplifting words with our young aspiring scientists on the continent. So you can find us on Facebook at Sunny, on Instagram at Sunny Podcast, and YouTube at Sunny Podcast. And please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. And as always, for our viewers on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, you can send us your comments on today's episode. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you once again, Dr. Nibia, and we'll talk to you on a later time in our next session of Sunny. Bye.
Thank you.